Welcome to Conversations on Buddha Nature. I'm Marcus Perman, Executive Director of Tsadner Foundation. Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature, hosted by Tsadner Foundation in association with the educational resource website, buddhanature.org. For this event, our regular host, Lopan Dr. Karma Phunso, will speak with the Thai Buddhist writer and scholar, Dr. Potpracha Cholvijan, also known as Achan Chok. You can watch all the past events on the buddhanature.org resource website, and they're now available as both video and audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. So please feel free to send questions with the Q&A function on Zoom, or if you're on Facebook Live, you can send comments during the discussion. Again, thank you so much for being here. We're honored to have Achan Chok with us here today. So far, our interview topics and guests have ranged across various Tibetan traditions of Buddhism. But today, we're lucky to have a specialist in Thai Buddhist traditions who has published a book about contemporary Thai Buddhist philosophical arguments that have interesting parallels with Tibetan Buddhist discussions. His book, called Nibbana as True Reality Beyond the Debate, in it, he analyzes several Thai debates that are quite relevant for Buddha Nature studies. So I hope to learn a little bit about that today. Achan Chok holds a PhD in Buddhist studies from the University of Bristol in the UK. He's also the author of Meditation Manual of King Thaksin of Thonburi and Ayutthaya Period Meditation Manual from Wat Prudhusongtham. Sorry, I'm going to be very bad at pronouncing things. My apologies. He is currently a special lecturer at the Thai Studies Center, Faculty of Arts at Chulalongkorn University. So as you all know, Lopan Dr. Karma Phunso is the recipient of Tsadner Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddha Nature Studies and is our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karma Phunso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Achan Chok joining us from Bangkok and Karma Phunso joining us from Bhutan.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone.
Welcome again to the Buddha Nature Conversations, and particularly to Achan Chok, who I think is our youngest guest so far. And of course, also from a non-Mahayana perspective, bringing a non-Mahayana perspective on the topic relevant to Buddha Nature studies. This forum, we have started almost 2 years ago to have a space for conversations on Buddha Nature to share insights, perspectives, experiences relating to theories and practices of Buddha Nature. And so far, we have only had guests from countries and cultures associated with Mahayana Buddhism. So it's really a unique and fantastic opportunity for us to have someone like you from the Theravada country and bring in again these wonderful insights and your knowledge on topics that are relevant to Buddha Nature studies. And so it's a great pleasure for us to have you. Now, we often ask at the beginning of this session how the individual, suppose you have done two theses, a master's thesis and a PhD thesis, on topics that are relevant to the debates that we have in the Mahayana and the Tibetan Buddhist world on Buddha Nature. So your works on self and non-self debates in the Thai Theravada tradition and on Nirvana as the ultimate absolute sort of self in the Thai Sama Arahan meditation tradition. How did you come to this work? I mean, how did you start this? What inspired you to do this work? Can you share us a little bit about the origins of your work?
Yes, it was very simple. I'm a practitioner of Samma Arahant meditation, but I come from a lineage of Samma Arahant meditation that is not so well known in Thailand. in a temple called Wat Lung Po Sot in Ratchaburi in Thailand, and my teacher, who I will call Ajahn Serm Chai, yes, he died in 2018 already, but he was one of my main meditation teachers since I was a child. He actually asked me to write this thesis for him, because he knew that I was studying religious studies at Bristol, and I was thinking about doing a thesis on Thai Buddhism. So he just suggested that I write a thesis on this topic, and he promised me that he will give as much help as he could with his side of the argument. But of course, I have to do on my own research of the other side of the debate myself. But with the Atta side, the self side, he provided me with most of the information I needed for the thesis. So it was quite easy and quite a well, it's easy decision, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, so you just mentioned Atta, Atma in Sanskrit, and self, as we translate in English. Most of the people here in the audience, and also most of the people associated with the Buddha Nature project, we only know of Theravada Buddhism championing the theory of non-self, anatta. But then it's so fascinating to discover that there is a very vibrant debate between the exponents of atta, self, and anatta, non-self theories within the Thai Theravada tradition. Can you give us a sort of broad background, a framework on how this debate is happening and how did they start?
Yes, I will share my PowerPoint with you.
Please.
Just a moment. So this is my PowerPoint. Just a moment. So this was the content of my master's degree thesis, and I selected five most prominent figures who written extensive and much quoted and much read arguments on both sides. Yeah, so one of the main prominent proponents of the not-self side is Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who really needs very little introduction, very famous Thai philosopher, scholar, and a reformist Buddhist monk who based in the Surat Thani, Suan Mo Temple in Surat Thani. And the second one is P.A. Payuto, who's a prolific scholar, writer, and of Theravada Buddhism, and who is currently a Somdet Pra Puttakosacharya. And he wrote a debate as he wrote a book called the Dhammakaya Case, which is as a reaction to the famous temple, Dhammakaya Temple in the Bangkok. Yes, and as a reaction to the publications regarding Nibbana and Dhammakaya, as a refutation of their understanding of Nibbana and Dhammakaya. But of course, the Dhammakaya Temple inherits the meditation system from this figure, Lung Po Sot Chantasaro, who was an abbot of Wat Pak Nam, or the founder or the father of the Dhammakaya tradition, the founder of Dhammakaya or Samma Arahang meditation. So their perspective of Atta is really inherited from him. So we move on to the self proponents. One of the main person who advocated the idea of Nibbana itself was Supreme Patriarch Paddhisattva, one of the few Mahanikaya Supreme Patriarch from Wat Sut That in Bangkok, and followed by the founder of the Dhammakaya tradition, Luang Pho Sot Chantasaro, from Wat Pak Nam. And the last one is my teacher, Ajahn Serm Chai Chayamangkalo, or Prathep Yan Mongkon of Wat Luang Pho Sot, who also inherited the Samma Arahang or Dhammakaya meditation from Wat Pak Nam. His temple is a small temple in Ratchaburi that is a branch temple of Wat Pak Nam in some ways.
So we, of course, know of the ancient debates between the proponents of the self and non-self theorists, like the Vatsiputriyas, one of the Nikayas. But this is a very sort of modern debate. The authors you show on the screen are mostly or all from the 20th century.
Yes.
How did this theory of the self in Thai Buddhism come about in the 20th century? This debate is quite new. What has inspired or what has triggered it?
I don't know for sure, but I think it's partly been inspired and triggered by the educational and monastic reform of the 19th and the early 20th century, which attempted to standardize monastic education in Thailand. It was started by King Rama IV in the 19th century and followed by his son, King Chulalongkorn Rama V, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And it may have caused a reaction. This standardization may have caused a reaction to many meditation traditions and many lineages which have held this perspective prior to the reform, I think.
What is fascinating for us, especially when we talk about parallels to Buddha nature, is the pro-self scholars and practitioners present Nibbana, or Nirvana in Sanskrit, as the ultimate self, isn't it? And it also equates that with Dharmakaya, or Dhammakaya in Pali.
Yes.
And that is the focus of the Samma Arahan meditation tradition that you belong, that you practice. So can you tell us a little bit more about how this theory of the self and Dharmakaya is the basis for the Samma Arahan meditation tradition?
So I will briefly talk about Samma Arahan meditation. And you can not interrupt me anytime if you don't understand anything, Karma.
Yes.
So Samma Arahan meditation, or Dhammakaya meditation, yes, was developed by Pramongkon Temuni Sot Chantasaro, the abbot of Wat Pak Nam in Thonburi, which is part of Greater Bangkok, yes, a small temple in Thonburi. And it consists of two preliminary techniques, which are: the first one is visualization of a crystal sphere entering through the seven bases of the mind, and the recitation of the mantra Samma Arahan. The reason why it's called Samma Arahan is because we recite this mantra during meditation as a preliminary exercise. When Luang Pho Sot referred to this meditation system, he referred to both Dhammakaya meditation and Samma Arahan meditation. But due to the popularity of Dhammakaya temple, in Bangkok, it has become a name that is more widely known. But in the temple that I practiced, Ajahn Somchai calls it Sammarahang meditation. In order to dissociate himself and his temple from Dhammakaya temple. And that is the reason why my thesis refers to this meditation as Sammarahang. This is what this is Longpo Sot Dantasaro, and this is my teacher, Ajahn Somchai, Prathep Yan Mongkhon, Wat Longpo Sot. And the word Sammarahang is repeated three times. When the sphere is moved to each base, yeah, there are seven bases altogether, yeah. And the last base is the two finger width above the navel. So if you place your fingers, it will above your navel, you are to visualize the crystal ball inside the stomach at that position. So you can see here. So first of all, you move the from your nostril to this behind the eye socket and down to the navel, and then two finger breadth above the navel. That is the center of the body, where the mind is supposed to be placed to a standstill, yeah, at the center of the body. So the, when the mind is stopped completely still there, a bright sphere of the size of the moon or the sun will appear at the center of the body. It is said that the meditator will see his or her actual mind or Dhamma sphere. It is called Dhamma sphere at this stage. The meditator reaches the Dhamma of a human, i.e. the purity of the mind equivalent to a human being. Why do I say human? Because from then on, as we progress through Sammarahang meditation, we go through 18 bodies altogether. When the Dhamma sphere is attained, the progress of Sammarahang meditation is to repeatedly stop completely still at the center of the sphere, at the center of the body, two fingers breadth above the navel. From this point, there exist internal spheres which lead to internal bodies within the human mind. So the sphere, there are bodies and spheres within the mind of the human in the area of the above the navel. Yeah, the subsequent inner bodies up to the highest body also reside within the minds of the previous bodies. To attain each inner body, one must stop still at the mind of the body that comes before it. So 18 bodies altogether, yeah, crude refined human, crude refined deva, this is the body of the gods, crude refined brahma, crude refined formless brahma, the first body to the eighth body are the conditioned body, yeah, and the nine to the 18 that we come to Dhammakaya. Yeah, when we get to Dhammakaya, we progress from the Godrapu or the change of lineage Dhammakaya, and then Sotapanna stream enterer, yeah, Sakatakami is a once returner, crude and refined, Anakami non-returner Dhammakaya, and finally Arahata or the enlightened, completely purified Dhammakaya. Arahata, yes. So the different stages of Dhammakaya are not only equivalent to the different stages of the noble person, but also to reaching of the triple gems, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha within. According to Longpo Sot, of course. In Longpo Sot understanding, when the mind of the Dhamma of the Buddha is reached, the body of the Buddha is manifested. So we are forming and developing the Buddha within the mind. That is the goal of Dhammakaya meditation. Yes, in referring to the Buddha within, Longpo Sot also incorporates the noble person into its definition. So at the level of the noble persons, even for those who aspire to become an arahant or has attained arahantship, the Buddha is also manifested. Also, it is called Anubuddha or Buddha who is a follower of the Buddha. So in reconciling the understanding in Theravada that an arahant is also a Buddha, because he is a Buddha enlightened, but also so follower of the Buddha as well. According to Mumposo, Dhammakaya is conceived not as a form, not as a material or matter, nor it is conceived as nimitta or a mental image. It is understood as an unconditioned, supermundane, superphysical body, which at the same time is also the source of Dhamma, or the teaching of the Buddha. Most Theravada understand Dhammakaya as the body of teaching, the source of the Dhamma, the body of the teaching, or equivalent to the Tipitaka, or the Pali Canon. But this interpretation is incorporated into Dhammakaya meditation, as well as also the supramundane body that is within each and every one of us. Longpo Sot combines the two different interpretations of the word Dhammakaya, metaphorical body as referring to a collection of teachings, and literal body like a physical body that can be seen, and finds no contradiction between them. So Dhammakaya in Samarahang meditation is supramundane body that of the one who has reached a certain amount of progress in meditation, and also the source of Dhamma, the body of Dhamma or teachings. According to Longpo Sot, the lower eight mundane bodies are made up of five aggregates. So these are the human, the Deva, the Brahma, and the formless Brahma are made up of the five aggregates. He's not denying that in his meditation system. The five aggregates consist of Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, and possess the three characteristics of impermanent suffering and not self. So these are the conditioned bodies, whereas as one progresses through each mundane body, one has to abandon one's attachment to the five aggregates of the lower bodies through contemplation of their impermanence, suffering, and not self characteristics. So the practice of Theravada Vipassana meditation is applied here in order to let go and detach from the mundane bodies and minds. Not just human, but Deva, Brahma, formless Brahma. However, this process ends when one reaches Dhammakaya, as the 10 supramundane Dhammakaya bodies are conditioned and have the opposite characteristic: permanent, happy, and self. Nityang sukhang atta. They are made of not of five aggregates, but what Longpo Sot call Dhamma aggregate, Dhammakanta. These bodies are described as liberated self and not conventional self. However, according to him, only Dhammakaya Arahata is absolutely completely liberated. All the Dhammakayas below it are not completely liberated, as they still have the lower and higher fetters or Sanyojana to be gotten rid of. Any question, Karma?
Thank you. That is a fascinating quick summary of the Samaran meditation. You mentioned Dhammakaya, and of course Dhammakaya that comes as a result, but then the meditation begins with the Dhammakaya as a crystal sphere in one's own body, right? Above the navel.
We don't call the crystal sphere as Dhammakaya yet, but the crystal sphere is
a sphere.
is a tool in order for one to be able to visualize and then come to the vision of the Dhamma sphere, which is the meditator's mind within the body.
So the crystal sphere, this is what I wanted to ask you, whether it has any connection to the luminosity of the mind that is the basis of Buddha nature teachings. And you find the luminous nature of the mind also taught in Theravada, such as the Anguttara Nikaya. So is this crystal sphere that one visualizes at seven different points actually the embodiment or the form that the nature of the mind takes?
Yes, the Dhamma sphere is the mind of the meditator, and it, when you come to the vision of it, it appears like a luminous sphere, like a sun or the moon, above, just right above the navel. And a lot of critics of Samarahang meditation, they find that what suttas or what canonical references can you find to support this? I mean, what is there any canonical references that you find you can find to support this idea? And hang on, I need to find
it. Yes. Yeah, thank you. So that was exactly also one of the questions I have, that when you talk about self in the Samaran meditation tradition or the Dharmakaya school, and when you talk about Nirvana or Dharmakaya as this absolute ultimate state of the mind, what do they base it on in terms of canonical literature?
Yes, that's right. So when Lungpo Sot talk about self, he talks about Dhammakaya as being a refuge, and he cites the two suttas that talk about having self as refuge, as shelter, which is the Chakravarti Sihananda Sutta and the Mahaparinibbana Sutta of the Pali Canon. And so this, he says, refers to the Dhammakaya within us. So when one reaches Dhammakaya, according to the apostle, one realizes that it's self, a true self that one can take refuge in. So it's not the same self as we ascribe to the five aggregates, you see what I mean? So it's not self that is that comes with attachment, that comes with defilement, that comes with clinging to the body or the mind. It is a self that is realized through detachment of the five aggregates, and realizing through that the Dhammakaya is the true refuge, because it's unconditioned, you see.
Is so similar to the Tibetan Buddhist sort of argument for Dharmakaya or the ultimate Buddhahood as the final refuge. I think there's such an amazing parallel between the two. But then if we go back to the verses that is being cited, that are being cited to support this, the verse that you find also in Dharmapada, you know, that one is one's own refuge or one's own guardian. And also the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, talking about one becoming one's own island and refuge. Those are basically verses showing that liberation is really dependent on oneself, not so much to talk about a metaphysical self as a Dharmakaya, as an ultimate nature. No, what's the take on this from the Samaran tradition? Because Buddha was mostly discussing the responsibility, the personal responsibility of somebody to be one's own guardian and refuge and seek Nirvana, and not so much about a sort of an ultimate philosophical self and refuge.
Yes, yes. A lot of critics of the Atta perspective also say that, and they often cite this verse, which is Zappe Dhamma Anatta, all dhammas are not self. Yes, referring to Nibbana as well. All dhammas referring to Nibbana are not self. But with this understanding, Lumpo Sot interprets the statement that all dhammas are not self as only referring to the conditioned dhammas, i.e. the five aggregates, and does not refer to Nibbana. Lumpo Sot has found that the minds and the bodies of the mundane bodies are still subject to the three characteristics, and there's no refuge to be found in them. Whereas you can't say that Dhammakaya is anatta, because Dhammakaya is a refuge, and something that is a refuge cannot be not self, according to him, you see. Because not self is the only characteristic that is linked to impermanent and suffering. It cannot be separated. It's like what my teacher Ajahn Seumchae said. It's like chain of three hoops. You know, when you lift one, you lift the other two. So when you lift impermanent, you lift suffering and not self. When you lift not self, you lift also impermanent and suffering. And so they cannot be separated, the three characteristics.
This is again amazing. There is a very clear parallel also in the Tibetan interpretation of Buddha nature, especially among the Shentongpas, the proponents of other emptiness, as you know. They also argue that Buddha nature is true and real. The Buddha taught as anatta or non-self only applies to non-ultimate conventional phenomena. So I find a very striking similarity here. But how do the other Theravada scholars and masters view such understanding, such an interpretation? A lot of the Shentongpas in Tibet, you know, the people who argue that Buddhahood is absolute and only of their self-existence, these people are sometimes even considered as heretical in their philosophical view. So how do the other Theravada scholars and masters view the Samaharan view of Dharmakaya and self?
Well, the critics of Samaharan meditation thinks that we are smuggling Atman of Hinduism into Buddhism, yes, into Theravada Buddhism. That's what they think, yes. But I guess they interpret them. Usually they use this verse as Sabbe Dhamma Anatta, or dhammas are not self, as referring to Nibbana as well. And and a lot of the debate, if you read my book, is about interpretation of the commentarial literature. And the way the commentaries support or negates this understanding. Because there isn't a passage that is attributed to the Buddha in the Pali Canon saying that Nibbana is self or saying that Nibbana is not self. So in my point of view, as a scholar, I mean, you, without the direct words of the Buddha, is still inconclusive whether the Buddha actually believed that the Nibbana was self or not, you see, as a scholar, because there's no passage in the Pali Canon attributed to him saying that it is or not, you see.
But what I again find very interesting that you cite in your thesis, the verse from Udana Varga, I think, talking about Ayatana Nibbana. I would like you to explain a bit more of what this Ayatana Nibbana is. But the verse, the text that you cited in your thesis says the Ayatana that we are talking about let me read out the verse. Monks, I do not speak of that Ayatana, that it is coming or going or remaining or falling or arising. That Ayatana is without foundation, without occurrence, without object. This is the end of dukkha. Now, this is almost identical with the description of the ultimate in the Mahayana Sutra or the Dharmadhatu in the Mahayana context. And for the Mahayana scholars arguing for an ultimate self or ultimate Dharmakaya, there are so many such Mahayana sutras, which all sides of Mahayana philosophical schools and sections would accept. I found this verse you cited very striking. It's almost like describing the Dharmadhatu in Mahayana. Are there many such verses also? Or what's your take on this? Can you explain a bit?
Yes, so I will explain
the concept of Ayatana Nibbana.
Yes, I will explain about Ayatana now. Another controversial aspect about this meditation, according to many Pali scholars, is the understanding of Ayatana. So according to Lopo Sot, the Nibbana is located in the mind of the Dhammakaya. When the Buddhas and Arahants still possess the five aggregates, they can reach the state of Nibbana in their minds at the center of their Dhammakayas. But when the Buddhas and Arahants pass away into final Nibbana, their five aggregates break up and their Dhammakaya will forever dwell in Ayatana Nibbana. So Ayatana, I want to talk about Ayatana briefly. Okay, so Ayatana, Lungpo Sot described as a dwelling place, but he does not mean that it is literally a physical dwelling place, like a house or a town, a city. According to his description of Ayatana, it is an unconditioned, supramundane, superphysical realm, higher than and more refined than the three realms. It is beyond the physical. There is no earth, water, fire, wind, sun, moon, going, coming, standing, arising, and birth in it. And it is a dwelling place of the Dhammakaya. There is a passage in Udana, which you just talked about, which the Buddha refers to an Ayatana, where there is neither earth, and no fire, no wind, etc. Yes, and this is Ayatana is the end of dukkha. Lungpo Sot talks about this Ayatana as a dwelling place. But a lot of scholars criticize this understanding as wrong, and they think that Ayatana just refers to the sphere of the mind that perceives Nibbana at the moment of enlightenment.
So I have a question. There's also discussion of or presentation of Nibbana as a glass city. Are we referring to Ayatana Nibbana through that metaphor?
Nibbana as glass city is quite a traditional interpretation. And it can be traced back to a late Ayutthaya period. And there's an article by Baron Jan Turville who shows a tripum, or the drawing of the three worlds. And the drawing depicts Nibbana as a city in that drawing.
Mm.
But Nibbana is a city in itself. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. But it's a metaphor that has certain similarities to Longpo Sut's understanding of Nibbana. Because if there is a state of Nibbana, yes, there must be the holder of that state.
Mm.
A state cannot just float in the air, you know? The holder is Dhammakaya,
mm.
according to him.
So that's, again, another very interesting thing that I find shared between the Samaran tradition and the Tibetan traditions. In the Tibetan traditions, when something is purified, there is a basis for that purification, jiangshi, as it's often referred to. Mm. And the same seem to apply here in the Samaran tradition, that when you clean something, there should be something to be cleaned, like clothes. So the Dharmakaya is the basis of the purification or the spiritual transformation. Is that right?
Yes. So Dharmakaya is described as the holder, or the where the state of demand Nibbana is situated, because otherwise Nibbana cannot just be floating around in thin air or in nothingness. Dhammakaya is a holder of Nibbana, and when there is a holder, there must be a place that the Dhammakaya dwells. So that place is Ayatana Nibbana. So when Longpo Sut refers to Ayatana, there is another passage from Dhammapada. This one, sages who do not harm, constantly restraining the body, they go to the place without birth where, having gone, they do not grieve.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher argues that Ayatana Nibbana is the abiding place of Nibbana Tatu, or the Nibbana element. Basically, Nibbana Tatu is Dhammakaya.
Mm-hmm.
Because that Nibbana Tatu is in the commentary is described as the holder of the state of Nibbana, or the nature where the Nibbana is situated, and is equated with Dhammakaya by my teacher Chan Sum Chai, who described Nibbana as having three aspects. One, the state of Nibbana, which is like the state, the purity of the mind, basically. The second, the holder of the state, or Dhammakaya, or Nibbana Tatu, which is Nibbana element. And third, the third aspect is Ayatana, or the dwelling place of the Nibbana Tatu, or Dhammakaya.
Mm.
And this perspective is extremely controversial in Thai Buddhism, of course.
And another interesting thing I want to ask you about before we open to the questions from the audience is, when you do the Samaran meditation, according to your thesis and what you shared today, we then, as we reach the final goal of the Arahant Dharmakaya, there is a Buddha figure that appears, and that Buddha figure actually has crown and necklaces and jewel ornaments. Now, the Theravada tradition doesn't generally accept the Sambhogakaya Buddha form. You have the Dhammakaya, and the Sambhogakaya is something you find in the Mahayana tradition. This Buddha that becomes manifest seems very much like a Sambhogakaya.
Well, Sambhogakaya is like the Buddha in the heavens, right? And the Dhammakaya is the enlightened aspects of that Buddha. That's how I understand it. But with Dhammakaya meditation, I think Sambhogakaya would be similar to one of the mundane bodies of the Buddha, or of the meditator. Because when we reach the Deva and the Brahma and the formless Brahma, they are described as having a crown and a necklace. But the appearance of Dhammakaya is pure white and translucent, like a crystal Buddha statue. You see. So maybe Sampokakaya and the Deva bodies are similar in the have similar aspects more than Dhammakaya.
Okay. Well, let's get questions from the audience.
Yes, there are some questions coming in.
Can I stop the PowerPoint now?
Sure.
Okay, right.
Thank you. Fascinating discussion. So one of the first questions is, how prominent or widespread are Thai proponents of the Nibbana as self perspective within either Thai literary commentarial traditions or Thai oral lineages of instruction? And is there historical evidence that this perspective is found in either sense prior to the 19th or 20th centuries?
So the proponents of Atta perspective are the minorities, and they exist in the different traditions of traditional meditation lineages, and which inherited or modified form of the older meditation system, which we call Boran Kamathan, or Boran, or the old meditation tradition. So the proponents of Atta perspective are the minority, because when they speak out about their opinions, yeah, a lot of Pali scholars, will refute them with publications and tracts, and they would call the attention of the Sangha Council, yeah, or the Department of Religion to investigate. You see, so it's always a problem to reveal your perspective when it comes to Atta, and most of them keep their perspectives to themselves, and among their close circle of students and disciples and followers. You see, only a few would dare to publish something like this. And my teacher was one of the few people who was daring enough to do it.
Fascinating.
And with regards to whether the perspective it can be found prior to the 19th century, I believe so. But I don't have not found any evidence of it. But the fact that Nongpa Sot and other teachers who hold this perspective, yeah, inherit a meditation tradition, that extends to the 16th century. The Boran Kamathana, or old meditation tradition, extend to the 16th century. I believe there are manuals and meditation system which would view Dhammakaya and Nibbana similarly, but they have not been found yet. The old meditation manual that I examined talk about Dhammakaya, but don't call it outright as self or Nibbana as self. They would talk about it in a mystical, a poetic way. Mm-hmm. That can be interpreted as such, but it's not like the Dhammakaya itself, Nibbana itself. I haven't found that kind of a statement yet in old meditation texts.
Right, but you have been researching old meditation texts, correct?
Yes. It's one of my main interests, actually. Pre-modern, pre-reform meditation in Thailand is one of my main interests, and it's part of my PhD thesis as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So there's also a question here. Is there a parallel here? Oh, sorry, Karma, you were going to jump in?
Yeah, I was just wanted to ask a follow-up question, and that is, as we often see in many parts of the world, and this has happened also with Buddhist traditions, you know, a lot of the old ones, particularly followed by a minority, may get gradually sort of exterminated by the mainstream orthodoxy. So if Sama Arahant meditation is connected to the traditional Borang Kamatana practices, is it likely that this practice, like Sama Arahant meditation, was quite common perhaps in the past, and then the more sort of purity-oriented orthodoxy in the Theravada system sort of eliminated them or suppressed them?
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's right. So meditation like Sama Arahant used to be the mainstream prior to the reform of the 19th century. Professor Kate Crosby has written a really good book on it called Esoteric Theravada, and you can investigate that book. And she talks about how this meditation tradition called Boran Gamatan, which means old meditation, can be traced back to the at least to the 16th century, and is the longest traceable lineage of Theravada meditation. And this tradition is, since the reform, has been suppressed and marginalized to the point of almost extinction. Sama Arahant is one of the few living lineages that survived to the present day, but in a modified, modernized form, of course.
Fascinating. All right. So another question is there a parallel here with Ajahn Mahabhua's description of the deathless citta as true self?
Yes, I have a PowerPoint about this, actually, if you want to talk about Ajahn Mahabhua, because I did say something about Ajahn Man, who is Ajahn Mahabhua's teacher, Long Pu Man, or the founder of modern forest monk tradition. Well, Ajahn Mahabhua, he did describe Nibbana as self in one of his teachings, but then he later on said that Nibbana is neither self or not self. So we don't know for sure what is his opinion on this, but with Ajahn Man, we have what we have in Ajahn Mahabhua's biography of Ajahn Man, the Thai biography, not the English translation, of course, because in the English translation it was omitted. We have, of course, the reference to the Puttosphere, or the treasure of the Buddha to be found within one's body, which enable one to gain knowledge of the three worlds. The Puttosphere is a glass sphere that is precious in the three realms. It is a sphere of cleverness, knowing all the three worlds. The Venerable Sphere is very bright, brighter than 100,000 suns, for the sun cannot illuminate heaven and hell to be seen, but the Puttosphere can illuminate all. The Butto is a bright glass sphere of numerous and uncountable colors. Butto is a splendid treasure of the Buddha. Butto is a bright body of knowledge and not material. This is in Ajahn Mahabhua's biography of Ajahn Man, which has been in Thai and omitted in the English translation. I translated this in order to show that even in Ajahn Man's teaching, there is a concept of a bright sphere which referring to meditative attainment. This is one of the main characteristics of old meditation, of Boran Gamatan, which is still exists in the forest meditation, in forest monk tradition, you see. And also another aspect is Ajahn Mun's visited by past Buddha and Arahants. When asked how the Buddha could appear resembling the human form when they had already attained Nibbana without remainder of the five aggregates, Ajahn Mun said this. This is in the English translation, but I have retranslated it. The Buddhas and Arahants ultimately exist as purified minds. Then man here. The purity of the mind that you have already seen is the Tathagata. Yes, the Tathagata who has come in this body, you may appear in human form, has come only in the conventional Sammuti form. If the other side, i.e. Ajahn Mun, has purity of mind but still possesses the conventional body, yeah, the Anupatisesa Nibbanasa, i.e. the Buddha, must manifest the conventional to him. So Ajahn Mun talks about the purified mind of the Buddha and the Arahats, able to manifest conventional forms to those who has attained Arahatship in his biography. But there is no statement by Ajahn Mun saying that Nibbana is itself or anything. But this is as close to it as he has come.
Fascinating.
Well, Marcus looks for other questions. I want to draw a parallel. So while Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Mahabua might have said Nirvana is neither self nor non-self, this is exactly what also some of the proponents of the other emptiness or also other schools who don't belong necessarily to the Shentong or other emptiness tradition say, that the ultimate Dharmakaya or the ultimate great self, the big self, is the one that transcends both the ordinary conceptual self and non-self. So there's a greater self that transcends the conceptual construction of both the self and non-self.
Yes, exactly. And that's and what I have emphasized in my book is that Ajahn Semchai, my teacher, has always said that, you know, Nibbana is of course devoid of a soul, of atta, in the sense of a soul, a being, a self, like a jiva, a life, a being, that is connected to the conventional self. But it doesn't mean it's devoid of the unconditioned self, the refuge, the true self.
And another parallel I want to again with is this use of the crystal imagery. Now, in the Vajrayana Buddhist tradition, crystal is used as a initiation nature of the mind. The Buddha nature is, and a crystal is often used to demonstrate the luminous nature of the mind to the disciples. So we find this very striking similarity in the use of the crystal imagery.
Yes, can I share my PowerPoint again? There is a passage that I want to show you.
Please.
So this passage is refers to the Kevata Sutta, and my teacher Ajahn Semchai usually say that the critics of Samarahang meditations always say Nibbana cannot be seen. But in here it says the Kevata Sutta say Nibbana that can be realized is Anidasa, cannot be seen with the physical eyes, Ananta, endless, without arising or passing away, the brackets are his interpretation, and has bright radiance clearer and purer than all other Dhammas. And there is a passage in Udana, water, earth, fire, and wind do not stand in Nibbana, in that Nibbana's stars' ray do not reach it, sunshine does not reach it, the moon's ray does not reach it, but there is no darkness in Nibbana. My teacher always say is that the both statement indicates that Nibbana is an unconditioned Dhamma that cannot be seen with the human eye, with the Deva Brahma eyes. But if it cannot be seen at all, the Buddha would not have described it as having a bright and clear radiance and without darkness. It is to be seen with Panyachakku, realized with wisdom, and also with the eyes of Dhammakaya. That's what he has said. When people argue against him, saying that Nibbana cannot be seen, he likes to argue back in this manner.
That's fascinating.
Marcus, any other questions?
Well, I have a question just from that. So that's really interesting. Is there also discussion of this ultimate Dhammakaya being impermanent or both impermanent or not permanent? Or is it always just a clear statement of it is the true self and it is permanent? Or is there sometimes a discussion of it being, you know, beyond either permanence or impermanence? Or is it, you know, is there a mixture there in the kinds of terminology used? Or is it always just in this tradition, I mean, in your teacher, is always clear statements? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this tradition, Dhammakaya is conceived as Nityang, permanent, Sukhang, happy, and Atta, self.
Right.
This is the teaching of the founder, Lungpo Sot.
Yeah.
Nityang, Sukhang, Atta, so opposite of the five aggregates.
Right. So it's never talked about also as it's always that kind of strong statement. It's never.
Yes, the start. Yes, that's right.
Wow.
And so he always says that Anityang points to Nityang. So it means that impermanence point to permanence.
Mm.
Suffering point to happiness. Not self point to self. Mm. It means that you negate the five aggregates in order to discover that the Dhammakaya is the true refuge. Mm. You see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Fascinating.
And no, Chuck, you find the same description of Dhammakaya in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the classic on Buddha nature, except that Ratnagotra Vibhaga adds one more element, one more characteristics, and that is purity. So there is purity, self, permanence, and bliss, or sukha.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I remember. Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Okay, well, if there are no other questions, I have a final question to you.
Yes, sounds good.
One of the other very, very sort of fascinating parallels you find is, you know, in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you have the Rangtongpas, the proponents of the self-emptiness theory, being more philosophical, more rational, and therefore also more scholarly and intellectual. Mm. And then the ones who argue for a permanent, absolute, ultimate self or Dharmakaya, the Shentongpas, they often say that this kind of inspiration comes from meditation and direct experience. So they adopt a more evocative sort of practical approach. And this seemed to be also the case with the Thai system. Now you have the mainstream sort of Thai tradition that's more rational, more perhaps philosophical. And then the Sama Aran and the other Borang Kamadhana being more experience-based, more mystical and more sort of romantic in their approach. Is that a fair description? If you look at the membership of the institutions, if you look at the amount of time spent between study and meditation, would you say that that is a sort of a distinction?
Well, according to my teacher, it is, yes, exactly what you said. But of course, I can't talk about that in my thesis because, all the followers of Buddha Dasa will all email me that he is a meditation practitioner. He is whatever, mm-hmm. He meditates all the time. He's a he's a great practitioner as well. Of course, I can't say that, but you know, but generally, I think so, because when I had to do a viva for this thesis, Paul Williams came up to me and said, you know, it's amazing parallel that that all the proponents of the Atta perspective, they make really great amulets. The three proponents that I mentioned in my thesis, yeah, are considered as a very mystical practitioners, and their amulets are considered as very sacred and and very prized objects in Thai society, basically, and fetch very high price nowadays after they died, of course. Yeah. They are known for amulets.
Would you mind sharing your personal experience using one of those amulets in London? I mean, I read that in the introduction of your thesis.
Yes, of course. Very briefly. Yes. Well, it's nice to close with that, isn't it? Well, I was in London with my family when I was 7, and I was just really happy to be going out, and I rushed across this busy road and got hit by a car, a very fast moving car, and the car just hit me, and I flew about a couple of meters forward because of the impact, and my father and my grandfather rushed me to the hospital to get me x-rayed and everything, but nothing happened. I had no injuries. Absolutely no injuries whatsoever from that impact. And even the paramedics were quite surprised when they examined me. And and of course my father attributed that to the amulet I was wearing, which of course my teacher was the one who made it, you see, and he believed that the amulet I was wearing was what saved me from that accident when I was 7 years old. And maybe, I don't know whether he's right or not, you know. Yeah, but 15 years later, I'm writing this thesis, you know, for him, so... I was writing this thesis for him, so maybe he wanted to save me until I'm old enough to write my thesis.
To do your thesis. Yes. So, Marcus, I think there is a request with one last question.
Yeah, there are several more questions, actually, but we're running out of time here, but maybe we could take a few more. Let's see. One is just maybe about the Arhat and Buddha distinction here in the Sama tradition. Is the highest attainment of the Dharmakaya is it Arhat, or can one attain Buddhahood as found in the Mahayana tradition? So is there a difference there in that tradition between Arhat and Buddha?
Yes, I think that is definitely a differences because according to Lopo Sot, when you reach Dhammakaya, is the appearance of the Buddha. You have become the Buddha inside. The Buddha within is attained. But of course, when he means the Buddha within, he refers to the noble ones. Because we're in the Theravada tradition, yeah? So he progresses from the stream enterer to once returner, non-returner to the Arahat. The Dhamma, different Dhammakaya refers to different noble ones. And the highest Dhammakaya is the refined Dhammakaya Arahata, or the enlightened Dhammakaya. And that's the highest Dhammakaya. And to call that as the appearance of the Buddha, yeah, means that he refers to the noble ones as the Buddha who follows the Buddha, or Anuputta, the one who follows the Buddha, but there are still Buddhas.
Fascinating. And in that tradition, did they attain omniscience, knowledge of all dharmas at that point?
Pardon?
In the tradition, do they attain omniscience? These Buddhas who are followers of the Buddha, do they have the same omniscience as the Buddha?
No, they would become arahats.
Arahats, okay.
But they could, of course progress to become the enlightened Buddha if they would like to become Bodhisattva. That's an option for that, like any other Theravada traditions.
Right. Okay. Fascinating. And then maybe just one more question. So someone's asking, do you anticipate any future social, intellectual, or sectarian developments in Thai Buddhism that might make the proponents of Nibbana as self more open and vocal in sharing their opinions and arguments?
Well, no. We will always be the minority, and we always have to keep our opinions to ourselves. I don't see any room for that, especially when it comes to something important like Nibbana. Because our situation, we have a very strong sangha, yeah, but at the same time its hierarchy is very centralized, you see. And we have a very centralized education system that controls every single monastery and every temple. And of course each abbot in the rural temples can adopt their own perspective, but if that gets in the news, they get investigated, you know. So they keep to themselves, all these people, they keep their perspective to themselves most of the time. And the fact that my teacher was able to publish all this is because he publishes and gives his publication, well, first he published anonymously, yeah, with a different pen name, yeah, and then he asked me to write a book in English, and then he distributed throughout the world, outside Thailand, of course. So people in Thailand who doesn't read English wouldn't be able to read it, you see.
Right.
So this also connects a bit, responds a little bit to the other question that we haven't taken about the impact of exposure to Western scholars and ideas on the Thai orthodoxy. I think there are also questions about your availability of your thesis. And also what I would like to add is your thesis would be something that a lot of scholars and intelligent readers would like to take up. But what other books can you also recommend on Samaran tradition? As you said, it looks like there are not many that are published because they are being silenced somehow. And then what exists also seem to be mostly in Thai language, which is not accessible to foreigners. So any titles you can recommend as an introductory material in addition to your thesis?
Yes, I have it here. So, do you want to know more about my publications? Of course, I have my master's thesis and PhD and other articles in here on academia, and you can download it for free. And this is my teacher's book in English, The Heart of Dhammakaya Meditation. Of course, it doesn't talk about Nibbana itself, but you can read it in order to familiarize yourself with Dhammakaya Meditation, Sammārahaṃ or Dhammakaya Meditation. And these are YouTube and about courses and YouTubes of him teaching it, and the courses at Wat Lung Po Sot. You can visit it to have a look. But of course, you can always approach the Dhammakaya meditation through other temples. You can go and look at the Dhammakaya temple website. There are plenty of information there you can consult as well. So,
thank you.
I've also posted links to the thesis and your book online in the chat, and also they're on the Buddha Nature website and on Facebook. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That was such an enriching, wonderful session for us. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and insights. Talking about Samma Arahant tradition, I am actually quite curious to even listen to the mantra itself. So if you may, we can conclude the session by having you chant the mantra in full, but up to you. Thank you for joining us and sharing all the insights with us.
You're welcome. And I'm glad to be here. I mean, it's getting really late in the in Bangkok, so I think you can visit the website to hear the mantra chanting. But I will have to go to bed soon. So
okay, yeah. No problem. I know it is very late for you. So thank you once again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karma. Thank you, Marcus. And thank you all participants. I hope you enjoyed this talk.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you, Karma. Sister.